Let's pray. Lord God, thank you for who you are and for your word to us. And Lord, help us to be a people who really know and understand and love the Bible and are effective and mature in using it in every area of life. Help us to that end, I pray, please. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so we're just talking about some ethical kind of dilemmas, and the main source that I'm using is a really pretty good book, Walter Kaiser's book, What Does the Lord Require? Although we're certainly going to overflow the boundaries of what he's discussed, but kind of like Kaiser, and that's where this began. So this morning, I wanted just to turn our attention to the subject matter of suicide and euthanasia. I don't know that you can entirely put them in the same realm, but we're going to attempt to do that for Sunday school. So, suicide actually comes from a couple of Latin words that refers to self-murder. The first known use of the word was in, I think, England in 1651, suicide. And of course, we understand that it is the intentional taking of your own life. And I'm not really going to get into this other than to mention it if you grew up in a Roman Catholic background, and maybe others, but Roman Catholicism in particular taught that, you know, suicide was kind of like the unforgivable sin. And I think, I'm not certainly not a Roman Catholic theologian, but since the last thing you do is take your life, that deprives you of the opportunity to confess that sin and to have it forgiven, and so you're kind of outside of the realm of forgiveness, I think would be the way that would go. And we would just, you know, kind of dismiss. You shouldn't do it, but it's not, you know, it's not the unforgivable sin. Euthanasia, on the other hand, comes from a couple of Greek words that refers to the idea of a good death. That amuses you? Good death? Well, you know, the Greeks were great philosophers, and they were also great pagans, so you're trying to reconcile life, right? An easy death, a peaceful and tranquil death, okay? And I'm just, obviously, I'm talking about some stuff. You know, we'll look at some of the biblical stuff. Euthanasia, of course, is assisting someone to take their own life in order to relieve pain and suffering. So this is the idea that drives it. Debates about the morality of these issues are not new. Some issues, I'm going to be really careful here. Some issues, the issues always exist. You know, the dilemmas always exist, life and death, right and wrong, you know, righteousness, unrighteousness. The technological changes in the world then force us into situations where we ask questions about whether or not specific things are sinful. And quite honestly, one of the great failings, and I really believe in some ways one of the greatest failings of fundamentalism, has been its inability to put those two things in their proper place. Fundamentalists are people who very much were inclined to make the application the principle. And so the application became the principle. Christians don't go to movies. That became the principle to us. Christians don't go to movies. So now you're trying to defend that biblically, and you lose sight of what the principle might be, and that going to the movie isn't in fact itself an application of the principle. One of our, and now I'm really off tangent here, but you know, whether or not to put somebody to a peaceful death, I guess is where I, in my mind, where this started, didn't arise when we developed the kind of drugs that we could inject into your veins and you would go to sleep and never wake up. It is a lot older than that. And so we have wrestled with those kinds of things for a long time. So the Greek Stoics advocated euthanasia for incurable diseases, right? These are the people that we, you know, we still use that word to describe people who just, you know, put their face into the wind and endure hardness as being kind of stoic. They were big advocates of euthanasia. Euthanasia, and sometimes even more barbaric means, which, you know, border on the forms of, you know, infanticide or genocide, had been practiced by many cultures to deal with special needs children or in instances of overpopulation. And I know I'm really off a little bit of a tangent again, but, you know, a few years ago, the Washington Redskins were really under political pressure to change the name of their football team because to call them the Redskins was politically incorrect. But it always amazed me that nobody went on a rampage against the Michigan State Spartans, which was a society that practiced widespread slavery and regularly placed children out in the elements to let them die if they were deemed unfit to live. And this is the way that many cultures embraced it. Here's a child. There is some physical, you know, disability with the child. What do? We leave it die. Here's a child. It's a girl. It's not a boy. What do? Leave it in the elements and let it die. So, you know, that's not really a euthanasia. And if you read Kaiser's book, I think when he deals with this section, he includes infanticide, but we're not even going to really get into that. So when we talk about euthanasia, philosophically, it is divided up into several categories. There is what is known as passive euthanasia, which is to withhold treatment from people. So we're not killing you. I mean, we're not injecting drugs into you that will kill you. We're just depriving you of necessary life substances, and then whatever happens, happens. And this was actually declared constitutional in the U.S. Supreme Court case Cruzan versus Director, Missouri Department of Education. Okay? Supreme Court of the United States rules that euthanasia is constitutional if there is clear and convincing evidence that the patient did not want to remain on life support. And it was this court case, by the way, that gave rise to these medical power of attorneys and the living wills that we see so much, which, you know, I mean, lots of you know, maybe not lots of you, but many of you knew Bob Martens. Bob Martens was a deacon here when I came here and retired from the post office and stayed here. And for many years, Bob was, you know, song leader, and his wife played the piano. And Bob had some surgery, I think, not really. I mean, you know, it was important surgery, but it wasn't critical surgery. And he had gone from surgery, and he had gone into rehabilitation. And while he was there, he had a heart attack. But he had signed an order that said, "Do not resuscitate me." And so when he had his heart attack, they did not attempt to save his life. They let him die. The legal justification of that comes out of the Cruzan case. So in the United States, some forms of euthanasia are permissible. You can, while you're in good health and of a sound mind, make the declaration that you do not want your life extended by feeding tubes and breathing machines, and you will be allowed to die. So, I mean, that's, you know, obviously you're going to have to sort through in your mind, you know, where that you and the Lord would fall in that, and exactly what would you know, some people don't want to be in a breathing machine, but they don't want to have food withheld. So, you know, those are okay. Then there is so there is passing or passive euthanasia, where we just let you die. There is active euthanasia, where we, you know, Jack Kevorkian kind of stuff. You know, here's the cocktail of drugs. Here's the IV. You push the button, and, you know, the thing kills you. There are voluntary and non-voluntary and involuntary forms of euthanasia. So, you know, you can say, "Don't let me live." Your family can make the case you wouldn't want to live, or somebody else can make the case you shouldn't be allowed to live. That's involuntary. So And it really is, you know, when the Affordable Health Care Act was passed in, what, 08 or 09, this was, you know, there was a lot of discussion about death panels, and that's what we're really discussing here, is some form of euthanasia. Will the government order you to be, you know, to be allowed to die or put to death or, you know, so. So those are kind of the, you know, if you go out into the world and start reading the literature and you go to Google, those are some of the issues that are going to be raised, you know, and since we're concerned with a Christian ethic, then we want to know, you know, where the Bible would leave us. What would the Bible permit? So let's try and sort through that. I would argue, this is the way I'm going to teach it, but I think that most of us would consent to the fact that the prohibition against murder extends to self-murder. That the prohibition against taking a human life, if I can't take yours, I can't take mine. The most fundamental crime in the commission of murder is destroying the image of God, Genesis 9:6. And since I'm in the image of God, to kill myself is to commit that crime. Now, again, you know, having done that, is that an automatic ticket to hell? I don't know that you can go there. There was, how many years ago was this? I guess it doesn't really matter, but one of the assistant, there was a man in one of the local churches who was an assistant pastor in that church who went off to become a senior pastor and who ended up, he came back to the Omaha area and he ended up committing suicide. Does this mean that he lost his salvation? No. Suicide, I think, violates the commandment and the intention of the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. So philosophically, theologically, do we have the right to take our own life? And do we have the right to take our own life by formulating as some kind of good death? There are 5 or 6 suicides recorded in the Bible. Abimelech, we got time. Judges chapter 9. None of which, I don't think any of us would think this, none of which are designed to be patterns for how to do it or endorsements of the activity. They're just recorded for us as statements of fact. And say, I guess got a problem. And then I realized that my problem wasn't Judges 9, it was that I was in Joshua 9. Judges 9:52, Abimelech came unto the tower, fought against it, and went hard unto the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman cast a piece of millstone upon Abimelech's head, and all to break his skull. Then he called hastily unto the young man his armor bearer, and said unto him, draw thy sword and slay me, that men say not of me, a woman slew him. And his young man thrust him through, and he died. So I guess you could raise the issue that that's more of a murder than a suicide, and it's, I don't know that anybody would call it euthanasia. Seriously, I'm not trying to be funny. I mean, because this man, Abimelech, is technically making an argument about the quality of his death. Right? It's an argument that's lost on us in our American culture. Right, but here's a guy who would rather be finished off with the sword than to have his reputation go down that he was killed by a woman. So that was to him the best of the options. Samson, Judges chapter 16. Let's just jump down to 1 Samuel verse number 29. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars upon which the house stood and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand and of the other with his left. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he bowed himself with all his might. And the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life. Then his brethren and all the house of his father came up and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zerali and Eshtaol in the burying place of Manoah, his father, and he judged Israel 20 years. So again, I mean, not straightforward, right? He killed more Philistines in bringing the building down upon his own head than he did in all of the battles that he fought against them. Perhaps one of the two most famous is going to be Saul, which again, raise the question, is this technically a suicide because, you know, he's calling for his armor bearer to slay him? But, you know, I guess what I would be, and, you know, for no reason. I mean, we're not trying to build a theology of the circumstances under which you should commit suicide and what it looks like. But, you know, Jack Kevorkian argued that he was helping people kill themselves, but he was nevertheless convicted of murder. And he was a physician, he put together the necessary drugs, he devised his little machine, he hooked you up to an IV. When you were ready, you pushed the button, the flow of drugs started. And so, you know, he was making the case that he was innocent. You know, and the jury said, "Don't think so," and they sentenced him to prison. So, Ahithophel, 2 Samuel chapter 17. This is certainly absolutely straightforward. Second Samuel chapter 17, verse number 23. "And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and gat him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father." I would point this out. Isn't it interesting, folks, that to this point in time in the biblical record, suicides, with the possible exception of Samson's, suicides have all been attended by large quantities of human pride. I don't want to say that a woman killed me. I don't want to say that an enemy killed me, and nobody did what I told them to do, so I'm going to kill myself. So these are never recorded as virtuous acts. They're always heavily attended by a large dose of insight into human depravity and the value system with which we measure ourselves. 1 Kings chapter 16, and we won't turn to this, but King Zimri killed himself. 1 Kings 16:18, and then of course number two up there, you know, with King Saul, is Judas Iscariot, who went out and hanged himself. And again, folks, I mean, the biblical record is pretty clear. Judas Iscariot was an unbeliever, and he went to hell because he was an unbeliever, not because he committed suicide. But he went out. which evidently, in his instance, is the way he was dealing with his guilt. Which... I want to be careful here because I am not saying that every believer who commits suicide, professing believer who commits suicide, is secretly an unbeliever. But there are better ways to deal with guilt than suicide. There are biblical ways of dealing with guilt. So human guilt is a powerful thing. But suicide is not the biblical answer to dealing with human guilt. So, but there are suicides recorded in the Bible. This is not new. You know, when my wife and I were teenagers, and even really, you know, she was working at a restaurant. I was a customer at a restaurant. That was our kind of our connection. And the common denominator there was the manager of the restaurant, who was a woman at that time in her late 30s, early 40s. We were a couple of teenagers. She was very instrumental in playing the matchmaker there. But she had a teenage son who had gotten into some kind of gambling trouble. Do you remember what it was? I want to say it was some kind. I mean, 14 years old, he shot himself, killed himself. So, you know, I mean, these things happen and, you know. So the Bible just, again, just records them as fact. It doesn't endorse them. It condemns those kinds of things. But you can find them there. And I guess the learning point for us would be, you know, to learn the kind of things that human pride, human guilt, huge factors, you know, avoiding unpleasant circumstances. All of these things are reflective of highly distorted views of ourselves and of the world around us. So anyway, we're just trying to develop some biblical. I mean, God gave us life, and it is our inherent nature to love life. And I read a guy one time, and I think he was right. He had spent many, many years as a Unitarian pastor, so you know we wouldn't be compatible. But he just made the observation that people who were trying to kill themselves were not really seeking less life; they were really seeking more life. This was what they wanted, was better life. to seek death is to fight against God, not the fight against God. Job chapter 14. Job 14:1, man that is born of a woman is of few days and full of trouble. He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not. And dost thou open thine eyes unto such an one and bringest me into judgment with thee? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? Not one. Seeing his days are determined, the number of his months are with thee. Thou hast appointed his bounds that he cannot pass. Turn from him that he may rest till he shall accomplish as an hireling his day. For there is hope of a tree if it be cut down that it will sprout again and that the tender branch thereof will not cease. So... So the question is, if you have a terminal diagnosis, do you continue on in the chemotherapy?
Continue with whatever treatment there may be. I mean,
can you turn? Yes.
And so it seems to me some of these people are actually fighting against God by continuing the treatment when death is going to happen.
Right. Yes. You're jumping into next week's Sunday school lesson. I mean, seriously, you know, when I got all done with this, Glenn, I thought, you know, I've kind of, it's kind of open-ended, right? I mean, so, you know, this is really what we're going to try and tackle next week is what are the boundaries of trying to alleviate human suffering that are acceptable? If it is God's will for us to suffer, and sometimes it is, right? What are the boundaries that we can... And I think a lot of us, that's really where we wrestle, is, you know, we, you know, as human beings, we know that death is an enemy, and it should not be viewed as any other. On the other hand, we know that death is the only really way that we're going to, you know, that is, apart from the rapture, is the only way we're going to get to the Lord, right? This is, so, you know, my enemy ends up becoming my access point to God, and so... So Glenn is absolutely right. There are times when I think we have to be in this position. There are times in which to run to death, right, is to fight against God, and sometimes to try and cling to life is equally to fight against the will of the Lord. Job certainly sees suffering as the normal human condition. And it is to one extent or another. I was reading a book on aging, and in one of the chapters, the guy's opening sentence is, "There are no non-sufferers in this world." And everybody suffers at some level, to some extent, in some way, as a human being. It is a cursed world. So Job sees that, and in verses 3 and 4 it appears that Job is questioning God's activity, and Job is trying to figure out, right, like we all are, is God doing this to me to punish me, or is God doing this to me to purify me? Right? I mean, what's the point of this? And if I just knew why the Lord was doing this, it would be so much better. And of course, Job's friends took the position that Job was being punished, and God took the position at the beginning and the end of the book that Job was being purified. And I think the human reality is that we're not going to enjoy it no matter what the explanation is. I mean, that would just be the way that... Okay. And so Job ultimately hopes in the passage that his suffering, which God has decreed, will turn to good. I mean, he is previewing there the concept of the resurrection. So... Okay. We would argue, of course, again, continuing how we would think about this, that God has a purpose for suffering. I think we would all stipulate that nobody really likes to suffer. You know, sometimes we talk about people who seem to never be happy unless they're unhappy, but I don't think that human beings enjoy suffering. I think that human beings, you know... and without getting too far afield, if you're familiar with John Piper, who for many years pastored Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota, he is kind of famous. He's a highly publicized author and a sought-out speaker, and we would have our issues, but that's another point. You know, he would identify himself as a Christian hedonist, that the basic, the fundamental appetite of human beings is pleasure and happiness, and that is a reflection of our createdness, that what God ultimately wants is for us to be happy and content in Him, that the idea, the basic idea of hedonism, pleasure-seeking, is not bad, and he gets kind of beat up a little bit on that by some people, but I think he's fundamentally right. Nobody got out of bed this morning and said, "I hope I have a terrible day." Nobody says, "I want to marry you because I think we'll have a wretched life." Nobody says, I want you to hire me because I know that I'll absolutely hate working here and I'll never make enough money to retire on when I'm old. If I get old, and I probably won't, because I hope that I get sick and wheelchair bound and drool all over myself. Those are my ambitions. That's what I really want. Nobody's like that. Nobody's like that. The things that make people happy to some of us are peculiar. But everybody is in the pursuit of some kind of pleasure. So, in a cursed world, nevertheless, we suffer. And part of the thing, and part of what we're going to try and figure out, I know that the world is cursed. I know that that's the will of God. I know that there's no escaping it. I know that death is coming. How much can I alleviate suffering without getting into a fist fight with God? So... Ecclesiastes chapter 12, for most of us, death is a bit of a process. We age. We slow down. In poetic terms, I mean, here's the explanation. Remember now, in verse number 1, remember now thy creator. in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Right? What do we say about our folks, and what are our kids going to say about us? They've lost interest in living. Right? While the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, has the sun lost its brightness measurably in our lifetime? No, but our eyes have lost their ability to perceive the sun in our lifetime. Verse number 3, in the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble and the strong men shall bow themselves. These are our bones, right? This is poetry. The grinders cease because they are few. Solomon, for all that he had, didn't have good dentistry. And teeth rot and fall out. Queen Elizabeth, one of the rich, and statistically one of the richest people to ever live in the history of the world, measured by for inflation. Certainly one of the most powerful monarchs in the world, spent much of the last part of the years of her life with a perfumed hanky in front of her mouth because her rotting teeth stunk so bad. So this is the way that people live. Those that look out of the windows be darkened, and the doors shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise at the voice of the bird. I asked the kids in chapel Friday, I said, so how many of you slept in on Thursday, the snow day? And all the hands go up. And then I just said to the teachers, how about you? We just laughed. Who sleeps in at our age? I sleep in. I get up at 6:30. Right? I remember talking to one of the guys that's about my age, and he said, he was reminiscing. He said, I remember when listening to my parents talk, and my dad would say, I didn't sleep a wink last night. And my mom would say, me neither. And I thought that was so dumb. And then I realized one day, that was now me. Verse number 5, and when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fear shall be in the way. Right? I get out of the truck this morning, and Clay's already got the lot plowed, and I'm walking across, and I'm thinking, Pastor Gary Walters, Pastor Gary Walters, Pastor Gary Walters, Pastor Gary Walters. Watch step, don't fall, right? We fears abound now. So for most people, this is the process. God has a purpose in suffering, and for most people, the process of dying, this is, folks, for most of us, the process of dying is part of the preparation for going to meet the Lord. Right? It is one of the ways that God has marvelously arranged the world in which he cursed, is that even in the curse there is some element of mercy, right? Ladies, this is purely hearsay. I could never speak to this out of personal testimony, but I have heard more than one woman say that they are so weary of being pregnant that they are ready to deliver the baby no matter what that entails. Right? That this is part of the way that God works in the world, that the purpose of suffering is to prepare us for what is better. John chapter 9, and right? This is the story of the blind man. I thought about this, Doug, in light of the conversation we had Wednesday about praying. So oftentimes we come to the Lord and we pray and we go, I got a dilemma and I don't know whether the answer is A or B. And then we're always amazed to discover God doesn't operate in a binary world. Right? So here's the binary dilemma. Here is the way the men are thinking. Verse number 1, Jesus passed by, saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents? Right? What is it, A or B? Did he do something wrong, or is he suffering because his mom and dad did something wrong? Is that me? Something you're ready to explode? Verse number 3, Jesus answered, neither hath this man sinned nor his parents. Right? Now, I mean, seriously, folks, I mean, be honest with yourself. What would your response be if you were a fully grown adult who had suffered with some kind of a debilitating illness or handicap your entire life, only to be informed that the whole reason you had lived your whole life like that was that so God could make an object lesson out of you? But that is Jesus' answer here in verse number 3. But that the works of God should be made manifest in him. I mean, there's no escaping, folks, that God took this man and he blinded him from birth in the house that he did, in the time that he did, so that one day he could intersect with Jesus and Jesus could heal him and everybody could know how great God was. Now, if we're suffering, it's pretty hard to think that way, right? Because we tend to be thinking about us. Right? And my guess is that there would be not an insignificant number of people who, upon getting that news, would be greatly offended that God would treat them so unfairly. But we are all, folks, we are all incredibly disposable. We just are. I mean, that hurts. That pains me at my core. But God needs a blind man. This is the guy that he picks. There is a purpose for our suffering. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. This will be the last reference. And then again, as we've kind of already Second Corinthians chapter 12, verse number 1. It is not expedient for me, doubtless, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago. Whether in the body I cannot tell, or whether out of the body I cannot tell, God knoweth. Such an one caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell, God knoweth. How that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Of such an one will I glory, yet of myself I will not glory, but in mine infirmities. For though I would desire to glory, I shall not be a fool, for I will say the truth. But now I forbear, lest any man should think of me above that which he seeth me to be, or that he heareth of me, and lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations. There was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice that it might depart from me, and he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure. You got your Greek Testament there, Bill. Is it hedone? Is it some form of hedonism? Therefore, I take pleasure. where am I here? Verse 10. I'm sorry. I'm looking down trying to find it in verse 12. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. I am become a fool in glorying. Ye have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended of you, for in nothing am I behind the very chiefest apostles, though I be nothing. Truly the signs of an apostle were wrought among you in all patience, signs, wonders, and mighty deeds. I'm just going to stop there. 10 was where I was supposed to stop. Right? I mean, God had a purpose in Paul's suffering. And folks, I think we need to understand that God has a purpose for us in our suffering, though we be not apostles. That is not the point. So this leads me again to one of the things that I think we'll try and work we'll introduce next week. I don't know that there's any way to answer it on behalf of everybody for all situations. But how much suffering can we alleviate? if it is the will of God to suffer and there is a point to it, how much of it are we permitted to address? Again, to come back to the subject matter at hand, I'm comfortable in arguing that taking your own life crosses the line, and that taking, you know, murdering somebody in the name of compassion crosses the line. That is a fitable approach for animals, but we are not animals in that context, right? In the modern church, folks, one of the fights that we have to fight, as ludicrous as it may seem to us, is that we are not just simply an integral part of the animal kingdom. Man is a distinct being. So we'll ultimately get to that, to the animal right issue and what to do about that. All right, any further questions, comments, observations?
Will you be delving into the scriptural portion of after death judgment and whether or not these events cross the line to God's sight at that time?
Will I be delving into these in the judgment standpoint? I hadn't thought of that. I'd give some consideration to that. We're certainly going to be judged for what we do in our bodies, whether it's good or bad. So, you know, we're going to answer to the Lord for that. So, all right. Oh, Rick, I'm sorry. But is that a bad prayer?
I don't know. You know, it seems like Paul approached it by saying,
well, but Paul said, I asked the Lord three times to take it away from me.
Yeah. Jesus asked God to live.
Yeah. I don't think, you know, that's right. Jesus said, if it be possible, take this cup. And I don't think there's any way to sanitize that. Jesus is a human being looking death in the face and going. So, you know, so I think, you know, this is going to become a part of her. I think we can legitimately pray and ask them, right? We're permitted, if not commanded, we're certainly permitted to pray for healing. We're permitted to pray for relief. We're supposed to wish for each other's well-being. So we hold that in this hand, and in this hand we hold the recognition that suffering is the will of God, and we're going to suffer in this world. So the never-ending tension of Christianity.